The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I would like to read a paragraph or so from a book by Tanisara Bhikkhu. He comes here once a year to teach for us, and abbot of a monastery in Southern California in San Diego. And he has a book, came out last year, called Skill in Questions. And it's a book about four different strategies that the Buddha used for responding to people's questions when they came to him. Or he might have had other strategies, but he listed these four as a kind of four categories of answers. And so he talks about those questions which should be answered categorically, meaning someone asks and it's a very clear, straightforward answer. This is how it is. Other questions that should be answered analytically. So you have to analyze, and you know, you take the question, you analyze the question, what's about the question in order to answer it, analyze the topic. The third kind of question is called cross question, where he calls it cross questioning, where you counter question, where someone asks a question and you ask a question, and the Buddha asks a question back, or asks a series of questions back, in order to clarify the original question. And the fourth category of questions are those questions that should be put aside, that you shouldn't answer. So this is this book, big book. And in this book he has this this statement, which I thought was kind of nice. An interpersonal dynamic in which the teacher is open to cross-questioning from the student and the student from the teacher provides an atmosphere conducive for establishing that the topics under discussion are reasonable and responsive to the listener's need. Even though the Buddha, in opening himself to questions, was also opening himself to arguments and debates, he saw that if the student was intent on learning, even a contentious exchange could lead to a positive result. It's possible to regard cross-questioning as one of the most introspective modes of teaching. Intersubjective modes of teaching. A teacher not open to cross-questioning is guilty of objectifying himself or herself and the audience. On the other hand, the way a teacher presents his or her teaching as a finished product stands on the foundation of objectification, of objectifications. And the teacher is then unwilling to open his thought, her thought, to the probing of others. On the other hand, such a teacher is treating his listeners as objects, for the teacher shows no concern on whether they will understand or benefit from the beauty or logic of his or her thought. However, a teacher who welcomes cross-questioning is concerned less with his status as a teacher and more with the communicating something clear and useful. In honoring his or her listeners' freedom to question, the teacher opens the discussion to their subjective experience of doubt and their desire for knowledge. Thus, a sincere exchange of questions, particularly around the primary common ground of subjective experience, that is, how to gain release from suffering and stress, is the pedagogical equivalent of thought prior to objectification. It's a little bit complicated, but the point is that Tanisara Bhikkhu says that basically, as a good teacher should be open to be questioned. And if you don't do that, if you just hold forth and just, you know, then you objectify your audience as if you know what they need, and you might not listen to what's really needed from the audience and hear what's, and be responsive to them. It's a sign of respect, even if there's contentious, the questioning that come. But also he mentions that the students should be open then for questions from a teacher. So I read this today, and I thought that's what we do today. So rather than me sitting up here and giving a Dharma talk, what interests me the most today is to hear what kind of questions, concerns you have about practice, your own practice, about this path to freedom that we're about here, path of mindfulness, of liberation, path of paying careful attention to our life. You know, and he talks about subjective questions, being subjective, meaning that which you can directly know yourself, as opposed to abstractions. So if we start getting into abstractions of, you know, metaphysical abstractions, then you lose that which is immediate in experience. And I think for Tanisar Bhikkhu, when he talks about subjective questions based on subjective experience, he's talking about those questions that are based on what you can experience for yourself, not, you know, some distant thing. Make some sense? So I don't know how that this works as setting up the evening. But I would be delighted, I think. I hope. to hear from you. What are your concerns? What kind of questions do you have? Some of you have been coming for a long time, listening for a long time. Maybe you have been wondering about things, you have doubts about things. You're troubled by some of the teachings from me or other Buddhist teachers. So what would you like to bring up? Yeah, Helen. And if you could use the mic, that would help.
Well, discouragement, that's what comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with discouragement? You have an idea of the ideal, which is to live in the love mode as opposed to the power mode. But it's an ideal, and I'm very conscious that I fall short.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so ideals are both meaningful and inspiring and meaningful for people to have a goal, a direction for their life. And also ideals can be quite painful to hold and difficult to hold, with a lot of expectation and a lot of measuring oneself. One of the aspects of an ideal that's keep in mind, it is that they are abstract, they're abstractions. And here in this quote that I read, the idea is not to be abstract, but to be immediate and subjective. So one of the ways meant to counter-question you is rather than asking about how to live by an ideal and the frustration, the despair, discouragement that come with not living up to an ideal, maybe we should back up, get back to the beginning of things, rather than we're kind of ahead. Maybe we're out in the end of a limb answering those questions. Let's get back to the trunk. And so back at the trunk, what has prompted you to be interested in ideals? What's motivated you? What's happening? What's happened to you? What's going on with you that you would be interested in an ideal that's different than what's happening here and now?
You want me to answer that?
Yeah.
Okay, going back to my original interest, a discovery at the age of 25, how it was actually possible to be happy. And it lay in my discovery of the metta bhavana practice. That happiness was... happiness, and not just equanimity, was possible.
Through metta practice?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, beautiful. So that's what you discovered. So what's the problem? Because there must be a problem that you're addressing, otherwise you wouldn't have this concern. So what's the problem that you're trying to address before we get into the ideal and the solution?
Well, I think it would be good for me if I practiced the metta bhavana more often. And I'm not.
Okay. So, a lot of things I wish I did more often. So, but what's the problem? I mean, that's just, it's nice. I mean, yeah, it'd be nice to do metta bhavana. It's nice to exercise. And it's many things that are nice. But you started off by saying you're discouraged, right? Something like that, right?
Yeah.
And you're discouraged because you're not living up to an ideal.
I'm not doing what I know at a cognitive level what I should be doing.
You should, and why do you think you should be doing it?
I suppose because I could do it.
That you could do.
Yeah.
So how do you, so there's a lot of things you could do, a lot of great things you could do, a lot of spiritual things you could do. Why do you choose that one to be upset about? I mean, you know, you could be doing concentration practices and jhana practice. You could be developing your generosity. You could be studying the suttas. You could do karuna practice. You could do visualization practices. You could. There's no shortage of things that you could do, and you could read a book on Buddhism and think, wow, there's a lot to do. I mean, why did you get in your idea that you should be doing these things, or even that you could? It's a serious question. So where did you get the idea?
Okay, Gail, you've convinced me. I'm going to start doing my metta-bhavana practice in the morning.
Just to avoid my questions? Well, we can pass the mic, but...
I don't want to hog the floor.
I think that, you know, we can do that, but I think that, you know, we can stop now, but I think that the people often, many people here practicing Buddhism practice with ideals, but sometimes it's very important to look where those ideals come from and why we think we want to follow those ideals, and are there different ways of holding ideals? So there might be a lot of things that are good to do, but then is it necessary, if we can't do it, is it necessary to feel discouraged? But then, so that's one question. How do we hold the ideal? What's our relationship to ideals? Is a very important question. Some people, and why? What are we measuring ourselves for? What do we think we'll accomplish if we succeed the ideal? The other whole investigation, there's the idea of back to the trunk of the tree rather than up in the branch, is that generally people want to practice something like Buddhism because they're suffering in some way. And so it isn't simply that they want an ideal, they want to attain something beautiful, but they want to avoid or not experience something which is not ideal, less ideal. They're unhappy in some way. So you talked about doing metta practice and feeling happy for the first time. That was a profound thing that you discovered that. And so I see that metta practice for you probably is an antidote then to feeling unhappy. And so that's great. So maybe that's important. But if you see the connection between the unhappiness, if you see what the problem is, then sometimes it's useful to actually study the problem better. Because if the problem is not understood well, and you're trying to overlay or get around it or through it, through an ideal, some idea what you're supposed to do, it might not actually be a good match or a good fit. So you want to get back to the trunk and back to the source of what has motivated you. And it might be you really need to delve into, perhaps, I don't know you well enough, but delve into what's the nature and the quality of that suffering that's motivating the whole idea for the ideal. And then is the ideal suited for what you're trying to do? Is there another approach, another way at this particular juncture, this particular time? Maybe you're 25, metta worked, maybe now it still can work. And then sometimes if you go back and look at the trunk, go back at the source like that, then you can also sometimes look and notice what is it that gets in the way of following through on the wish to do the ideal. There's a lot of obstacles, a lot of motivational issues that can stand in the way that might be hard to understand unless you actually turn back and look more closely at what's actually going on. And if you simply hold, I'm not saying you're doing this, but if a person simply holds the ideal, I should be doing this, and beat themselves up because I'm not doing it, there's a whole bunch of stuff that they might be not seeing in themselves, which might be useful to see. The ideal sometimes can blind us. So that's why I wanted to ask you questions to probe backwards into the source for you. That was what's going on. So thank you. Someone else?
Not so sure I want to do this now. what do you do when you find your practice sort of, you enter into a kind of a state of dullness or kind of a kind of apathy. And it's almost as if my best meditations are when I'm suffering and trying to work something, and when I reach a state where, you know, I'm relatively free from suffering at the moment. I wouldn't call it equanimity exactly. But anyway, that's sort of the dullness, I guess, or the apathy.
In meditation itself.
In the meditation itself, but in my interest and in enthusiasm and in coming and actually meditating, kind of like, okay, I'm not terribly unhappy, so I don't need to meditate as much, or something like that.
So you're most motivated and inspired when you're suffering.
Yes.
Yes, it's a good observation. It's great to see this, and so you're asking a question: when you're not motivated, when you're not suffering, when you feel basically content or happy in some kind of way, you're not so motivated to practice, and practice feels kind of flat.
Yeah.
But you're not satisfied with that.
That's no.
So can you talk a little bit about that dissatisfaction? Can you fill me in? What's that dissatisfaction about? It seems like might be a good dissatisfaction. It's a useful dissatisfaction. Maybe you can kind of pull out, what's going on with that dissatisfaction? Why are you dissatisfied with that?
I would say that I'm cut off from, or I feel a little cut off from feeling in general, which may be partly that I don't know how to handle happiness very well.
I see. So when you're suffering, you really feel, you feel kind of connected, alive, you kind of know what's going on. But if you're not suffering, then you get a little bit disoriented. You're not quite sure what's going on. You're not so used to it. Like the famous story I've told a few times of the woman on retreat who came to the teacher and said, I'm experiencing something really unusual in meditation. I don't know what. The teacher said, what is it? Well, I'm not really sure what it is, you know. And the teacher said, go back and look more carefully. And the student came back a few days later to the teacher and said, I discovered what it is. I'm calm. And I've never been calm before. It's a new thing. So there's something. Something's going on for you where you're not used to the terrain. You're not used to how you are. You don't feel connected to yourself in this kind of state. So I think that's really useful information. So with that information, with that as a clue, what would you think would be a useful thing to do?
I guess just to maybe it is uncertain terrain. I guess just keep on doing what I'm doing. I mean, keep on meditating to the degree that I do and enjoy the sangha. And wait for it to change.
That's good. That's nice. Here's another thing you might do, is when you find yourself in those states, why don't you investigate it? Look at it more carefully. Look in the nooks and crannies of it. What does it actually feel like? What does it feel like in your body, your mind, your heart? What happens emotionally? What happens in your thoughts? The quality of your thinking? What happens the quality of your body? How do you feel in your body? What happens when you're not suffering. Maybe you're not so flat. You're saying maybe it turns out you're not so flat. Maybe there is a kind of happiness or well-being, but you're not used to it. And it's not motivating because you're used to being motivated by suffering. So I think, it might be a really important step for you to start getting familiar with how you feel when you're not suffering. And you might learn a lot about yourself. And you might learn about what can motivate you and inspire you, that's not conditioned by suffering. So I would encourage you to get really interested, say, oh boy, and say, what's going on? And it might not be clear at first, But see if you can open yourself to that experience more fully. What's this going on here? What's going on here? And feel it and be with it. And there might be layers of things to discover in this experience. Some of it might be comfortable and some of it might be uncomfortable. But just keep opening to it and see what happens. And if you need to get more motivated to do that, then it might be helpful to remember the times you suffered. And remember, oh yeah, I'm capable of suffering. And now that I remember it, I really want to get to the bottom of this life thing. And here I have a chance to see a whole other aspect of my life. And maybe there's a real key here to something profound. So let me be motivated to look more carefully so I don't keep falling back into the suffering.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Okay, so usually when I encounter an unpleasant situation, I think of sort of like this is the reality of the situation.
It's going to be this way forever.
Yeah, it's going to be like this forever.
I'm going to be depressed, you know, forever. the delusion, I call it the delusion of permanence.
Right. So I recently came across a suggestion that said, well, maybe you could actively entertain alternate reality, so to speak. And I don't mean that in like completely fantasy land, but like, you know, maybe take a different perspective from the situation that's plausible. That may not be the first thing that comes to your mind. That actually isn't as much of a suffering for you if right. you can envision that. And perhaps that could actually be the reality. I mean, so it could be, basically what I'm realizing is that a lot of times when we lock into suffering, we think of it as the reality, perhaps it's just a reality of what's right. going on.
Yeah. So I'd be a little bit careful myself with the language of reality.
Okay, fair enough.
Because it makes it feel like it's real.
Okay, all right. Maybe a different perspective.
And then people get kind of. It's very easy to get locked in. It's
okay.
I have my reality, my truth, and you have your truth, and there's all these multiple truths, and it gets and then you can't talk to people.
Okay.
But what you might try might be more useful for you and kind of help you be more open to look into the experience if you realize that there are multiple perspectives.
Right. So I was going to say maybe
multiple interpretations or perspectives. Right. And so sometimes it's very useful to look at the perspective you have and then creatively think, are there other perspectives that are as valid or more useful in the situation? So that remember many years ago, we were having trouble at home with my child. It was very frustrating, and I succumbed to the delusion of permanence. I know better, but still, my mind knows nothing's permanent, but my heart didn't. and so we were struggling at home. My wife looked up at me and she said, "Oh, we're having one of those days." And that was a whole new perspective. Oh, just one of those days? You know, it's just a day. You know, things come and they go. It's just one of those days. It's a hard day. And tomorrow will be a different day. And that just popped the bubble. And I wasn't so oppressed by the situation. My son wasn't any easier, but I wasn't oppressed by how I was holding it and caught up in it and everything. So I think it's a very wise thing to spend in our lay life, consider that maybe the perspective we're operating under is not a useful perspective, especially if we feel burdened by it. And see, can you look at a situation from a different perspective? Sometimes you can ask help from other people. Are there other perspectives to understand this? You know, I go to work this week, and my boss has been really nice to me for a long time, for years, but my boss is really mean this week. And, I just feel like I'm just, that I'm just really failing in my work. I'm probably going to lose my job soon, or I'm public enemy number one at work, and, it's all about me. And then go to a coworker and say, can you give me a different perspective of what's going on here? And they say, oh, yes, your boss, his spouse is dying. And the parents have Alzheimer's, and the boss can't juggle both things. And it's just not sleeping and stressed out. And And so the shortness that they see in the boss comes from this difficulty the boss is having. So, oh, I had no idea there was this personal life. I didn't think bosses had personal lives. And so that changes the perspective. So that's what I offer.
Right. Thanks. My question is about attachment, and you know, attachment can lead to suffering, and specifically attachment to a vision of one's life when the vision of one's life no longer matches that attachment. So I underwent a huge life change 4 years ago, away from a life that I thought was amazing, and it led to a lot of suffering because what I was experiencing no longer matched who I thought I was, what I thought I deserved in life. And fairly recently, I've after 4 years of paralysis, I've made some big changes that are creating forward momentum, all of that. I am now being inundated with pushback from some pretty important people in my life about these choices, and it's making me question and therefore becoming attached to these old images or visions of who I am, who I should be.
If your friends want you to be the old you.
Pardon?
If friends want the old goals?
Kind of. So, for example, you know, I professionally had a certain career that had a certain amount of prestige to it, and I've recently taken a position that people, I've literally had people in my life say, oh, isn't that beneath you? How can you do that? Really? You? I was so excited to have this new opportunity and excited about the forward momentum it was creating in my life. And as recently as 3 hours ago, I bumped into someone that said, did I hear that you're doing X? I'm like, yeah, I am. Really? I thought that was just a vicious rumor. So here I'm excited to be gainfully employed at something that's beneath me, and have worked so hard at letting go of the trappings of my former life, and yet I feel like I'm being inundated all around me. And to kind of piggyback on what someone else said, you know, it's I'm holding on to my I'm really coming back to my meditation practice, especially now, like, oh, please help me, let me just breathe through this and believe that the forward momentum I'm creating is going to get me where I need to be.
Great, it's wonderful.
But letting that attachment of who I used to be go. You know, I thought I was making all this progress, and now that I'm being inundated by, really? You're doing that? It's torpedoing. Yeah.
Well, what you're experiencing is what I think many people in different ways can experience. When we start living, having a sense of different values to live by, sometimes our friends and family who live by the old values have trouble with that transition. And so, I mean, a very simple thing that I've seen many people do when they start practicing a fair amount or meditating, it's not uncommon for people to start becoming interested in their speech and wanting to speak better, speak in ways that are less divisive, less gossip, less slander. And you know, in the coffee room at work, it's all about gossip. And so they don't feel comfortable anymore. It feels kind of yucky to do it, so they don't want to do it. But then now they feel like they're different from everybody, and there's a lot of pressure to get back into the gossip. And then you feel outside, and you feel like you're kind of weird because you don't want to do it, but everyone else is doing it. So there's many things like this where we start pulling back from certain values, a certain attachment, certain involvements, because they don't feel good anymore. But the society around us is supporting us to get back in, and feels like you're kind of strange if you do it. So in that sense, it's often very helpful to be around other people who share your new values. So you've come here tonight. So here, it's not strange that you're letting go of a sense of self. Because, I mean, I hope not. I mean, that's kind of like, and this is kind of what we're, kind of one of the main things we're trying to do, is to free ourselves from that kind of attachment, clinging, limitation that provides. So that gives you, realize, you know, you're not that weird. There's a room full of people here who look pretty normal. That's one thing to say. But this is the more important thing I want to say to you. Instead of answering your question of how to deal with these attachments and all that, it might be useful for you to spend a little bit of time getting yourself grounded or connected in a strong way to what you've really learned through this process. What have you really learned about attachment to self? What have you learned about, or what are you learning about how you listen to other people's opinions of you and how you relate to it? And what do you, if you really spend some time looking into these issues and what you've learned or what you think is what your values really are, and try to go through the behind the curtain of all these people's ideas and your anxiety and your concern about what other people are saying, I suspect that you've learned something really important.
Well, that's the silver bullet I was hoping for in asking the question. Is, the old adage of those who matter don't mind and those who mind don't matter. And I'm really trying to put that into effect right now in my life in all areas. But I'm realizing that I still really do care what people think of me. And I still really do care that I am no longer, in many people's eyes, what they thought I was.
Great.
And who I was.
So this is a great insight that you really care. You're still caught in that somehow. That's one of your attachments. Not just a sense of self, but what other people think of you. But there's a lot of people who have that attachment, and they don't know it's an attachment. They just live it as if that's how it should be. You're here in front of a lot of people being very articulate, saying you have this struggle, but you're very conscious of it. So you understand something. You know something. You're caught, for sure, but you have some wisdom as well. Otherwise, you wouldn't be struggling right now with this.
Any suggestions on specific practices on how to release that?
Two things. I would put a little bit repeating myself. But one is, study this phenomena really well. Just be curious how it works and how it works in your mind and what are the emotions and feelings that come up and what goes on in your body. And just turn around and look it right in the eye, this tendency of how you are with other people. Look for people to be around where they really trigger you. And if you really want to do the advanced course, if people trust you enough, tell them what's going on for you. Say, you just said, isn't this beneath you? And you tell them, I'm doing this kind of mindfulness thing, and what's been really interesting for me is to see how I get caught by when people say, isn't that beneath you? And how I'm so caught up in what people think of me. And you've given me an opportunity. I don't know, you want to say it in a way that they don't feel offended. But sometimes saying out loud what you're struggling with to people is a very freeing thing, rather than keeping it private and hidden. And it might actually help some of your friends to kind of free themselves from kind of holding this towards you, because that's one thing. And then what I said before, I think you know something good, something really good. Otherwise, you wouldn't be struggling. Can you get yourself grounded in the wisdom that you have that's behind your struggle, the reason you're struggling? There's something good that you have that is causing you to struggle with it. Because if you didn't have that good thing, that good understanding, some good sense or something, you would just go, get absorbed in the struggle without even knowing you're struggling. Just be miserable.
Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. So in the outer hall, if you can maybe take the mic out there. You have one. Okay, great. There's a mic there.
Is that on? Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. There was an exercise in the mindful meditation course that had to do with being mindful or what our attitude about our mind was and doing an exercise. And I tried doing it, and I didn't get too far into it without thinking that my mind is really crazy and it's a bully and it's bugging the crap out of me. And I know that I've felt that way for a long time but didn't really be specific about it. And I thought, my attitude about my mind has been sort of negative for a really long time. And Is there something sort of helpful to, a helpful hint or a way to go so I can sort of have a better relationship with this thing that I don't feel good about?
So somehow, you know, in some deep way inside of you, in your mind, how your mind operates and thinks and sees, and that there's a bully that's kind of, it's harsh, it's difficult mind, right? So many people can behave that way in obvious ways. Imagine that there's a girl comes in here to the room. Maybe she's 7 years old, and she's a bully and harsh and judgmental and all the ways that your mind is. What would you do for her?
I guess I would try to find out why she's so difficult or angry or badgering.
Uh-huh. So you'd try to find out. And for a seven-year-old, how would you go about doing that? She doesn't really know you. So how would you kind of approach her so that she'd be willing to share that with you?
I'd ask her how she feels.
What else would you do? This is good. This is great. What else would you do? How would you approach such a person, so a seven-year-old, this way? What would you do for her? What would you do for her besides kind of, you know, what would you try to do for her? Maybe she's even upset about how she is. She feels bad about how she is.
I would try to let her understand that I wanted to listen. That it was okay to talk about it.
Beautiful. And what would you hope get conveyed through wanting to listen? What else would she pick up through you?
I guess that it's okay to have all that stuff going on in the first place.
Because you wouldn't want to start asking questions and find out what's going on. But, you know, this is really wrong, and you shouldn't be this way. And let's get to the bottom of this. Right? That wouldn't work, right?
No.
So it'd be much more somehow some certain kind of acceptance. But you don't want to accept that. Oh, it's fine. Just suffer away. Also. But some kind of listening that's kind of accepting her, holds her, is with her in a kind way, accepting way.
Yeah.
And there might be other things. You might consider this a little bit. Now, from this perspective, is there some way, something you can learn about how to be with yourself now?
Yeah.
You got some, yeah?
That's good, yeah.
Try to do this for yourself and see what happens.
Okay.
Just behind you, last one tonight.
So I guess I've been practicing for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and I don't have a lot of stress, say, things in my daily life, and so I make up stress by worrying about things in the future.
It's important to have your quota of stress.
And they kind of, you know, grip me like they're happening now, but they, you know, some of the things, you know, they will happen because they typically involve death, but not for my parents, probably 10, 15 years, and me, maybe 40. But it still kind of grips me as if, you know, something I have to deal with now, like, you know, I need to turn a car or I need to think about something, but it's still kind of...
It grips you. The future grips you.
Yeah. Usually bad things in the future. Usually I don't think of good things happening in the future.
So it might be helpful to consider that the ideas, the thoughts, the image are the future. It's kind of a virtual reality. It might happen. Some things are guaranteed to happen. You know, so it's guaranteed you're going to die and people you love are going to die. So some things are guaranteed. Some things are unsure how they're going to happen. You don't know. But it's a little bit of a virtual reality, the future. But the gripping and the churning, the concerns about the future are always happening in the present. And so one of the approaches of mindfulness is to turn away from thinking about the future. Don't be future-directed, but turn your attention 180 degrees around to really be present. What's going on here for me now? What's happening? What are the emotions? What are the motivations? What are the beliefs? What are the energies? What is it? What is the tension that I'm experiencing here and now in relationship to it? And it's not uncommon for some people's preoccupation with the future has actually nothing to do with the future, but has a lot to do with attachments and fears that they have here in the present. And it's really present moment thing. So, and to the degree to which we keep looking into the future to solve that kind of attachment, we're missing where the real issue resides. So I would encourage you to turn around and come back here in the present moment and to feel what's going on here. And maybe you were a little bit too quick to say, here and now, there's no problems. There might not be any conventional problems, but probably deep in your heart, there's still something that's somehow unsettled. And because of that, the heart is unsettled in some way, the future is troubling for you. So what is unsettled here? And then sit with that. And be very, 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 very generous to yourself. And come in and sit with your unsettledness. Be very quiet and still with it. And be very permissive and open to it to show itself. And see what opens, what transforms. Okay? Okay, thank you for those who ask questions and were willing to at least look like you're willing to engage back as I asked you questions and explored it. But to me, it was very nice to hear. I hope for those of you who didn't ask questions, it was meaningful to hear from other people in the community the kind of concerns they have and what's going on. And it'd be nice if maybe some of the responses or some of the things that were discussed may be relevant for some of you. And I certainly appreciated the chance to hear a little bit from you all and what's going on for you and your concerns. And so I appreciate that, and thank you very much.